Welcome to episode 11 of In the Garden. This is the Iowa Blog, and I am your host, Craig Wynn. When last we encountered Chawa, the actual name for the woman in the garden, Eve is the name of a pagan Mother Earth goddess, showing how disrespectful every English translation is of the names that Yahweh has chosen, showing a complete disregard for his choices, thinking that they're at liberty to change every name, even his name. They replace Yahweh's name with the Lord, and in this case, they have replaced the woman's name, Chawa, with Eve. Nevertheless, the story is that then the woman, she looked and she saw that indeed the tree, and it's interesting here, of course, it's not mentioned, but this is the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, that it was beautiful and pleasing. That was her perception of it. And indeed, it is highly likely, since God created and the garden was a beautiful place, that the tree did look enticing. And clearly, knowledge is something that people pursue, that we find exceedingly valuable. So the woman looked and saw that indeed the tree was beautiful and pleasing. She perceived it as a source of food to consume for nourishment. That's part of the problem. We can become what we consume, and that indeed it was visually appealing and desirable, even eliciting cravings. And this is another one of our problems as human beings. We take a superficial view to a lot of things and don't actually consider what's beneath the surface. A great example is that most recently, an exceedingly courageous and compassionate man became famous in Sweden for burning Qurans. And it was a superficial procedure that he and display that he found appropriate because of the fact that Muslims in Iraq, where he had come from, his family was Syrian, excuse me, Christian, and the government that America established in Iraq thought it would be good fun to herd up about 250 members of his extended family and community and burn them alive. And so he was clearly motivated to show some form of protest against them, and burning the Quran, the very book that inspired the heinous behavior, seemed appropriate. But as much as I respect the man for his courage and for being willing to risk his life, he was murdered by five Muslim men 2 days ago. It's still a superficial thing. It seemed appealing and enticing for him to burn the book. And my view is, burning the book, you're doing a tremendous favor, actually, to Muslims. Because it's by reading the book and finding out what it actually says that, well, you would come to the conclusion it's the worst book ever written. It has no value whatsoever. It is mean-spirited and repetitive and plagiarized, has very little original material in it, and is presented in a jumbled mess without any chronology or context. I mean, by any rational and moral standard, the Quran is the worst book ever written, and it's exceedingly murderous, calling on all Muslims to fight and kill for Allah. And so this is an example where if you had actually considered the contents, you'd know that it's far better to expose it than it is to consume it. And in his case, the appearance of torching the Quran really wasn't the best approach. We want to read it so that we can denounce it. So as this statement goes, the woman looked and she saw that indeed the tree was beautiful and pleasing as a source for food to consume, and that It was visually appealing and desirable, even enticing her cravings. It was perceived to be satisfying and was seen as a jealous inclination for the eyes. So she coveted, she lusted for, she intensely desired the tree to impart insights and to inspire success, even to convey understanding. Chacal, to provide the wisdom to be prudent so as to acquire additional skills and prosper. Therefore, she grasped hold and seized from the fruit and she ate. Then she also gave it to her man who was in a relationship with her. So then he ate. Bavrishith in the beginning, 3:6. In this statement, I've made a big deal about the fact that almost everything about this particular tree that Yahweh described as the tree of Tob, good, and Ra, bad, that which is wrong and counterproductive as compared to those things which are beneficial and correct, all in the same source of information. And her view was that it was visually appealing. It was desirable. Now, this would be desirable to go against Yahweh's instructions. Now, he didn't say don't eat from the tree. He didn't issue a command and say, thou shalt not eat from that tree. He actually said, you can eat from any tree you want to. Just understand that if you eat from that particular tree, if you make a habit of eating from that particular tree, and the day that you do that, you're going to die. Your life is no longer going to be eternal. So it was cause and consequence there. And she wanted to test the limits. She had been told by Hasatan, the Kerub, who had twisted Yahweh's testimony, that if you eat it, you absolutely will not die. Muth-muth. So she now thought she could disregard Yahweh's instructions and have no consequence because somebody had misrepresented Yahweh's testimony to say otherwise. This was the problem. So she coveted. The one thing she knew from the instructions that she had been given that would cause harm to her, that she had been encouraged not to do. Well, you can do it, but you understand there's the consequence. She nonetheless coveted that thing. You know, it's like having a parent tell you that you can play with every toy in the house, but don't play with the glass sculpture sitting on top of the counter there, because you'll break it. And getting fixated on that one thing and disregarding all of the age-appropriate and beneficial toys and coveting that one thing because you were encouraged not to do it. That's the position she was in. Therefore, she desired insights, success, understanding, wisdom. She coveted things, but she didn't want to work for them. She didn't want to do the investigation and the effort that leads to understanding. Now, in my particular case, I've got 35 books sitting behind me that I have written over the last 23 years that I have poured anywhere from 10 to 14 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week, over the course of 23 years into composing. I have worked at acquiring knowledge and then developing understanding. She wanted it in one gulp, as if, boom, there you go. You know it all. It is something that I've talked a lot about on these shows recently, that Yahweh's procedure with virtually everyone that he works with is not to do a data dump. Here you go. There's all the answers. Now have a good life. If I need you for something, just spew out what I have told you. Call it a day. You've got all the answers. You have no more questions. That'll be it. Under that basis, you might as well use a voice recorder. No purpose of engaging a human in the process. And so that's not the way it works. With Yahweh, you have to do what Dode did. You have to do what Moshe did. You have to study what God has said, think about it, ponder all the implications, analyze it, make comparisons. And then over time, you gradually learn. And each day, you know more than you did the previous day. And therefore, you can refine your understanding and convey what you have learned. That is the nature of the process. This isn't one bite and you're done. And one thing will never do it. Taking one sip here of my tea isn't going to cause me to understand all beverages. You have to invest considerable time, and to do so, you have to examine every leaf of every tree and every bush and every shrub and every animal and every rock along the way. But anyway, she coveted instant insights. Therefore, she grasped hold of from the tree and she ate. And so she gave it to her man, who was either there or came in shortly thereafter, and he ate. No questions. No, we should discuss this. No, you know, that probably wasn't a real good idea. It went against what Yahweh instructed us to do. And probably you should set that thing down and toss it away, maybe spit it out, and let's go and talk it over with Yahweh and see if we can work this out so that we don't suffer the consequences. Okay. But that's not what they did. Anyway, Chawa made a conscious but conscientious choice. There wasn't any involvement, I don't think, of her conscience in this. It was consciousness where she saw and she responded, as opposed to using her conscience. The difference between the nefesh and the nesama, the nefesh that she had enabled her to perceive what was around her and respond to it. Her conscience, which is the nesama, would have given her the ability to think about it and make a rational and informed decision, which was not what she did. So she looked, she liked what she saw, she was enticed by the possibilities, and she seized on the opportunity. There would be no fact-checking, no attempt to compare Satan's counterfeit to the original instructions. Chawa didn't turn to Yahweh and ask for clarification on his guidance, nor did she discuss this with Adam. Enticed by bad information, she made a poor choice. A superficial one at that. The tree appeared good to eat, looked pretty, and it was visually appealing. I think a lot of people have made decisions on that basis. I think many people have chosen their presidents and prime ministers on that basis. I think a lot have made poor choices on choosing their spouses on that basis as well. Just saying. Now, imagine that. When you put it all together, she forfeited living with God in the garden based upon insufficient and irrelevant observations, all based upon pretense and opinion. Yes, next time somebody says to you, I'm entitled to my opinion, okay, what's that going to get you? But isn't, you know, that what every religious person has done throughout history? The faithful never compare their religious claims to God's testimony, because if they did, they would recognize that their beliefs are predicated on lies. And that's the basis of goddamn religion. It is the basis of Babel. It is the basis of the books that I wrote on Twistianity, 13 of them. And what they do is they compare false prophets with what Yahweh actually conveyed to prove that those religions and the books supporting them are completely erroneous. Now, addressing his relationship with Chawa, the next text states that Adam, that he was in a relationship with her, which is to say that he was associated with her in this decision, and thus considered, is considered really similar to her. M does not infer that Adam was standing next to Chawa this whole time, or that he had been a party to the exchange with Satan. It just means that they were of one accord and fate, necessitating consistent consequences for similar choices. Unlike Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, there would not be a double standard, with the woman being blamed for man's mistake. In fact, in this case, I think Adam was far more to blame than was Chawa, because Yahweh's instructions had been offered to him, and it would have been his responsibility to not only inform Chawa regarding what Yahweh had said, but the moment he was shown what she had done, he should have immediately said, "Fortunately, he spoke to us." Now, I don't know if he would have known the imperfect from the perfect, but he spoke to us in the imperfect conjugation. And therefore, the communicated instruction was, we should not make a habit of eating from this. If you set it down, you're not eating from it, and it's all going to be good. He didn't do that either. So I think that Adam could have kept the problem from happening had he done his job, had he been a responsible individual in this case, and then he could have eliminated the problem, resolved it by subsequent instruction. This handsome fellow here, this is Wookie. He likes the story of In the Garden, so he wanted to participate in this particular program. Who's to tell Wookie no? So, lacking any information to the contrary, the implication is that Adam lacked the good sense and character to challenge the majority opinion. If so, he represents most people today. They do not possess the character, the courage, or the conscience to make an unpopular stand, even when it's against something decidedly bad, and even when it's good to do so. Had Adam countered the adversary's enticing solicitation by correctly citing Yahweh's instructions, all would have remained good. Had he encouraged Chawa just to set down the fruit, she would have remained by his side in the garden. Everything would have been good. Now, this is true for all of us because Yahweh conveys instructions such as these in the imperfect. And that speaks of ongoing behavior. All we must do to stop being bad is to start being good. The corollary is also true. And it's reminiscent of something that we talked about last night. If you stop being good, you can be perceived as bad. Relationships require ongoing commitment to be valid. Well, Adam would ultimately have his relationship with Yah reconciled, and likely for this very reason in general, most people in this situation will eventually die rather than experience the anguish of eternal separation. It is a horrible thing to encourage others to reject God, while less objectionable to succumb to enticements. Those who promote mischaracterizations of Yahweh will be held accountable for robbing their prey of their souls. As a result, Sheol will be much more popular than Shamaim. Covetousness is what caused Satan to rebel against God. Something which is made abundantly clear in Yeshaya, Isaiah 14. This realization is also reinforced throughout Ezekiel, albeit from the adversary's perspective, giving us another insight into his fall from protector to destroyer. We see Satan beguiling Chawa into coveting what God had discouraged. The result would be separation. As we consider the consequence of this choice, be aware that the protective covering of the garden is symbolic, really, of the set-apart spirit. The moment that Adam and Chawa chose poorly, they lost that protection and appeared naked in God's eyes, as well as their own. The garment of light that Yahweh offers, can be perceived as keeping him from seeing our faults. And what I just shared with you is something that I came to conclude. Oh my, I'll bet you it was 17 years ago. I was reading from the prophet Yeshaya, and there was this mention of a garment of light or luminosity. And so the natural inclination was to see that as the Spirit's gift, so that we might appear perfect in God's eyes, because the requirement of the covenant is to walk to Yahweh and be perfected by him. And this seemed like the natural answer to that question, even though it's really not said anywhere that this is a spiritual garment, or that it's applied so that Yahweh can't see our faults. The very idea was that if we have darkness within us and this darkness is subjected to the light, the darkness goes away. And, well, that's a reasonable deduction from the evidence. I've subsequently learned that it's not necessary. There is no reason for Yahweh to cover anyone in a garment of light. And this is because on Matzah, Dod took our guilt with him into Sheol to deposit it there and never to be seen again. Now, this is actually germane to this point of this discussion, because Yahweh said that, you know, the day that you eat of that tree, you're going to die. So they were now on the path to death, and they had on their souls the stigma of disregarding Yahweh's instructions and not valuing and not acting upon what he had conveyed to them. So coming to the realization that Dod's soul carried our guilt into Sheol to deposit it there, well, it took 20 years of study, because to recognize that's how the fungus of yeast, which is religious and political corruption, is removed from our souls so that we appear perfect before God, necessitates us first coming to the realization that Dod served as the Pesach AL. My co-host here wants down on the floor, so excuse me while I help him. It's a long way down from the desk. So the first thing you have to come up with is the realization that Dod served as the Pesach AL because, well, Passover is part of unyeasted bread. So the 3 days, Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, are one collective whole. So the resolution on Matzah has to begin with Pesach. Now, I came to recognize that Dod was the Passover lamb by confronting the first 30 Moed Mizmor, the Psalms, as I translated them probably for the 7th or 8th time and was rewriting coming home. It became obvious to me that Dod had volunteered to do this, and Yahweh had volunteered to accept his son's sacrifice in that regard, seeing the both of them seeing the benefits in doing so. And then I realized, yes, indeed, there's a reason that the 22nd Mizmor is written in first person. It's Dode's first person account for what he himself would endure. So once you come to that position, and then you, and it takes years, years and years and years of studying Yah's testimony before you're prepared to understand how Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim were fulfilled. So once you can come to the point that you understand how Pesach was fulfilled, which took me a better part of 18 years, next you have to understand then how did Dode and his Bashar body now being sacrificed on Pesach and his soul remaining. And we know that from the testimony in Yashaya 53 that he was laden with the guilt of the covenant family. And we know from Mizmor 22 that after Pesach, he went to a place of separation and extreme darkness and pressure. And so from these things, this is the whole concept of being and understanding. Once you know them, which took years, you're now in a place to understand the process. Once you understand the process, then you know there is no guilt to cover up. You don't need a garment of light to wipe out the darkness because there is no darkness. It has all been carried away and placed in Sheol, which is essentially a black hole. Now, by the time you reach that point, you go back and say, okay, well, every reference that I have to a garment of luminosity, I should probably change because, well, the fact of the matter is there is no guilt to cover. There's not even a reason to save because if you're perfect, because now you are, your guilt has all been taken away. Therefore, you appear perfect to God. The mechanism is not necessary. Now, to come to that conclusion took 20 or 21 years of study. It was not one bite of an apple. But it helps explain how you can use metaphors, how you'll try to figure out, well, how does Yahweh solve our guilt? How is that accomplished? And it takes an enormous amount of study and making the proper connections and getting to know Yahweh and his son, Dode David, exceedingly well before you can come to that place. So this continues. So the eyes, perceptions, and perspective of both of them were opened. That is true for anyone now who is exposed to good and bad, right and wrong. Your eyes should be open. It's why I'm a huge proponent of free speech. It's why I think that the more people know, the better it is. And then we should be trained to chokmah, to use our ability to process information rationally and be discerning to determine what is good and what is bad, what is right, what is wrong. Their perceptions and their perspective, both of them were open, and they recognized as a result that they were naked and exposed. So their nudity, while they were in a relationship with Yahweh, was a good thing. When they were estranged from Yahweh because they had not followed his instructions, nudity was perceived to be a bad thing. Therefore, if you look at the religions of Christianity, which have, you know, women, oh, I'm going to be dressed up like this, and, you know, the don't show any ankle, and Islam, where women are told to wear garbage bags, the very fact that they are embarrassed by being exposed tells you that they're being religious, that they're estranged from God. Those who are estranged from God see sexuality as fornication and evil, twisted and perverse and corrupt and of the flesh. Read Paul. Whoa. And those who know Yahweh see sensuality, sexuality, physicality is beautiful and pleasing. So this is a profound insight that I don't think has been previously shared that might be helpful to you. So then they stitch together fig foliage, acting to make for themselves a covering. I can just see them stitching together fig leaves, but nonetheless, that is what it says. And the reason it likely says that is that the fig would later become symbolic of Yisrael. And when the fig is in full bloom, if you will, then Israel is growing and healthy. And when the fig withers, Israel is sick and dying. And so that is likely the result here. But there is more to it than that. Most people who are not exceedingly familiar with Yahweh, who are not genuinely part of his covenant family, view themselves as vulnerable. A great example would be when Yahweh came off Mount Chorab, and the purpose was to speak directly to the children of Yisrael and to tell them in no uncertain terms, this is my guy, this Moshe right here. He's my guy. I chose him. I am speaking through him. You need to trust and rely upon what he says, because we're going mouth to mouth. Even that, mouth to mouth. I was having lunch with my wife today, and I said, so, sweetheart, do you know why he said mouth to mouth as opposed to mouth to ear? And I said, don't feel bad if you don't know the answer first time through. I didn't either. In fact, I said, why did he say that? Why didn't he say mouth to ear? Well, because if you recall earlier, he told Moshe, don't worry about your mouth. I designed it. Well, in Moshe's case, he spoke through Moshe as if he was using Moshe's mouth, as if Yahweh's mouth was Yose's mouth, Moshe's mouth. So here you have a situation where the children of Israel, I am sorry for all these little detours in different places, but there's just so much to share. And the more I think you know, the more hues of this and shadings and lines and gradations of this picture that you know, the more comfortable you're going to be with Yahweh, and the more welcome I'm going to be in your home, because I'm building a base of knowledge that will help you understand what your options are relative to God, and then how to engage appropriately to maximize that opportunity. So anyway, Yahweh started talking to the children of Israel, and we're going to say, well, that's really cool. We're delighted to know, Yahweh, that you are God. Thank you for delivering us from the bad guys over there in Mitzrayim. That was really a bad experience. It was quite the journey, man. The whole, you know, parting to the sea and all the thing, that was a really good trick. And we're happy to be here and everything. So now that we've gone through all of this, could you please shut up and go away? Now, why would they tell the God who just liberated them from 80 years of being slaves to shut up and go away? You ever wonder? Was God sending down lightning bolts to burn their little britches? No. Was God casting aspersions on them? No. Had they been little shits? Mm-hmm, they had been. They had been embittered malcontents from the beginning. They knew they were naked to God. They knew that they had been irascible and embittered and contentious. And they knew the darkness that lurked within them. And they didn't want that exposed to God. So, goes right back here. They knew that they had disregarded God's instructions. Yahweh had been exceedingly good to them. They had no reason to disregard his instructions, but they did anyway. I know some former covenant members that are in that same situation. They did anyway. And as a result of doing so, they realized they were naked and exposed and therefore vulnerable. And anytime somebody shines a light, and Yahweh is light, on a vulnerability that you're trying to hide, it makes you really uncomfortable. That's why the fig leaves. Adam and Chawa had, of course, seen one another naked countless times. So the reason for the hastily crafted sash was that with the exposure to malevolent thoughts, they now felt vulnerable. The addition of bad had become a burden, precluding the enjoyment of something designed to be attractive. Doing the wrong thing ruined a very good thing. Nudity was desirable until their thinking was corrupted. I have concluded that the same is true today in every religious culture. And make no mistake, dressing women up to hide everything, even making them cut off their hair, is an essential element of ultra-Orthodox Judaism too. All religions are keen on not allowing women to be free to show themselves. It is curious that the first thing they came to realize from having gained access to greater knowledge was that they were now unprotected and thus vulnerable. They seemed to instantly realize that there would no longer be any protection from God. They had chosen to be on their own by disregarding Yahweh's instructions, and worse, augmenting them with their own. They had become self-reliant. And the history of civilization portends mankind does very poorly left to our own devices. In the next statement, most English Bibles are one to render la ruach ha-yom as in the cool of the day. But la means to or toward, not in. Ruach means spirit, not cool. Moreover, yom literally means to be hot, making cool an oxymoron. It is not that the translators don't know that ruach means spirit, can also mean wind. It is correctly translated as spirit. 232 of its 378 appearances, and almost all of the remaining as wind. It is rendered as cool only once here in Genesis 3:8. And since Satan is a ruach, you have to be really careful when you talk about ruach, because not only Satan a ruach, but all of the demons that he elicited to join him are also ruach. So there was a spirit to be concerned about on this occasion, rendering cool a very poor representation. Now, during the entire process of betrayal, there has not been a single reference to Yahweh's name. It is something that this episode shares in common with Judaism and with Christianity. And now on the cusp of being judged, they would hear it again. And those of you who have stepped away from Yahweh or have never come to know him and have misled people through religion or conspiracy, even of politics, then you're going to know it again in the end. And they heard the sound of Yahweh Almighty walking in the protected and enclosed garden regarding the spirit of the day. Therefore, the bad Adam and his woman withdrew and hid their presence from the presence, I should say, of Yahweh as Almighty God in the midst of the garden's trees. Baruchit, in the beginning, 3:8, they would have done much better and have certainly fared better listening to Yahweh prior to this moment. As a matter of principle, we should listen to him now and benefit rather than later while being judged. The spirit of concern on this day was Hasatan. His errant citations and misappropriations of Yahweh's testimony would cast an appalling shadow upon the earth, occluding the light for millennia. It was also the result of Adam's and Chawa's poor choices. By reading this, we know that Yahweh was physically present with Adam and Chawa. Now, all of Yahweh doesn't fit into a human being, so the entirety of Yahweh was not walking in the garden. But just as Yahweh has a ruach that he can project from him to convey his maternal and feminine attributes, Yahweh also has a nefesh soul, which is also, by the way, feminine. And the nefesh, he can project into any physical construct of his choice. And so, since Yahweh created all the animals, including man, he could have made a physical being and placed his nefesh inside of that physical being so that he could commune with Adam on his level and could enjoy all of the beauty of the garden that he had conceived. And so this is likely the way that that occurred. It would be very much like we witness in the movie Avatar, although they wouldn't be green. Or no, I guess that was blue. They wouldn't be blue. And they wouldn't, Yahweh wouldn't have to sit in a little tube to make this possible. So it is likely that that is the method of accomplishing this. So it's true that he had done this enough times that they were familiar with him and they recognized his stride as he approached. This is something I find very comforting because as we go from being physical beings trapped in the ordinary flow of time, and you can tell I'm still struggling from a scratchy throat, that we have our aches and pains and life, to energy-based beings that are liberated in time, can travel through dimensions greater than those we currently know, and are greatly enriched and empowered by the experience. There are still many things that I enjoy, and I'm sure you enjoy, about being a three-dimensional being. Touch, taste, sound, sight, the ability to walk in a garden, the capacity to enjoy a good meal, to feel the warmth of the sun, the cool of a stream, to walk among the animals, to enjoy the touch of a lover. All of these things necessitate a physical body. Even to celebrate the Moed Mikre on a time schedule in eternity requires us to be able to transition into a 3D model in the ordinary flow of time. Because as an energy-based being, time simply exists. So I'm not just hopeful of, based upon Yahweh's experience here and what he has offered us and what Einstein discovered in terms of energy equals a matter times the speed of light squared, so that energy and matter are the same things. They're just different amounts of the same thing organized differently, but essentially the same thing. That this ability for God, who is a seven-dimensional spiritual being, to project his nefesh soul, his consciousness, into a physical being for the purpose of enjoying companionship and the garden, I find very appealing. That suggests to me that even during the millennial Shabbat, those of us who have previously been brought to Shamaim and made this transition to spiritual being, that we will be able to take on spiritual or physical form when it suits our agenda. You know, we can take a walk on the beach, something that is highly enjoyable and desirable. So this is actually a big deal when we realize that they recognize his stride as he approached. Now, spiritual beings like Satan, particularly as a Kerub, can move without walking, and they are silent. Therefore, it is safe to say that this represents the first of what will become, I think it's seven specific, at least announced appearances that Yahweh will make by projecting his personal nephesh soul in a corporeal form. The final will be upon his return during Yom Kippurim, 6,000 years distant from this day, although then I think that the form is going to be a mixture of energy and matter. The reason a physical manifestation of God is depicted here for the first time is directly related to Adam's and Chawa's current state. They had fallen and would benefit from a helping hand. They would also be confused and bewildered, desperately needing God's guidance at this time. There would be a consequence of their failure to respect his teaching, but Yahweh would deliver it in the least threatening way possible. Now, there are three interesting shadings to the word withdrawn hide, which was conveyed in Hebrew as chaba. And a plain rendering of the text conveys that the consequence of rebelling against God is that they chose to withdraw and hide. Those who do so are separated from him. But by using withdrawn, God is revealing that, excuse me, this sinus infection is going to get the best of me here, but I'm trying to fight my way through it because I know that continuing to provide these programs is important. That separation was their choice, not his. Further, the first couple was aware that they had made a poor decision and that their nesama conscience helped them realize that they should feel a sense of remorse about what they had done. Even to this day, guilty people flee the scene of a crime and try to hide from responsibility and consequence. That is what occurred here. They knew they were guilty. And the guilt was of disregarding Yahweh's instructions. Lastly, chaba is the root of chabab, which means to fervently love and cherish. During their time in the garden, Adam and Chawa had come to love Yahweh, and they cherished their close and personal relationship with him. So when they were beguiled by Satan's play on words, they recognized that they had hurt someone they cared about, even revered. And I dare say God was also hurt on this day. When we disappoint those we love, especially our parents, the last thing we want is to face them. Well, fathers know best. Yahweh would kara, invite them in a welcoming way, and call out to his now estranged children. From this day forward, there would be seven invitations annually, each designed to facilitate humankind's return to the garden. Yahweh, which is God's name, transliterated as guided by his Torah instructions on his Haya existence and his role in our Shalom reconciliation as our Eloah, Almighty God, who is God Almighty, called out to the man, Adam. And he asked him, "Where are you?" Bar Rishith in the beginning, 3-9. So may I ask you the same question? Where are you? Are you Halak, walking toward Yahweh along the path he has provided through the Mikre? Have you answered his Kara, invitations to meet and to be welcomed into his company? Or are you like so many others, and especially Yehudim Jews, who are chaba, withdrawing from God? Have you returned to Gan, the garden? Or are you still outside? Separated from God, head swirling with all manner of ill-conceived notions, was the answer in Adam's case. His intimate relationship had been spoiled, a consequence of not listening to Yahweh and then choosing poorly. There was a right answer to Yahweh's question, one which provides the way back home. Kara, which is translated as called out, means to invite, to summons, to meet, to greet, to welcome, even to recede, to read and to recite. It is the actionable root of Mikra, the title Yahweh selected for his 7 annual meetings, for us to be called out and meet. And it is these meetings which provide the benefits of the covenant, allowing us to re-enter the Gan Eden. With his 7 Mikre, Yahweh is summoning us to meet with him, to be welcomed into his company, just as he called out to Adam on this day. Over the years, I have shared some thoughts regarding Shavuot's state of mind, suggesting a number of possibilities, including the idea that she may not have enjoyed Yahweh's company to the same extent as Adam, and may have resented his relationship with God. Now, this is extrapolated from the text, predicated upon Yahweh's response to her. And here, in this prior statement, we're confronted with the realization that God was searching for Adam, calling out to him individually, rather than to both of them. And then corroborating this assessment, consider Adam's answer. He said, "I heard something sounding like your voice in the garden. And because I was naked and exposed, out of reverence and respect, I was concerned and I withdrew, having foreclosed something that I once cherished." Barishith in the beginning, 3:10. They had adorned themselves in fig leaves and branches, so he was not physically naked now. That was not why he withdrew. He was now bereft of Yahweh's glorious presence, and he saw himself as flawed, vulnerable, exposed, and mortal. He knew he would eventually die. He was guilty of doing something wrong, and he felt filthy. So he realized that he was no longer prepared to be seen in God's presence. In this way, he represents how sullied Yisrael has become by turning a deaf and rebellious mindset to God. And most Yehudim will continue to retain their guilt until they are cleansed and the end by the sacrifice of the Adam HaPerah on Teruah just prior to their return to the garden. With their nesama conscience, or capacity for rational and moral judgment functioning, Adam and Chawa recognized that there was a reason to be concerned, even intimidated. The God who had been their friend, their loving father, had been hurt by what they had done. Out of respect for him and who he was, they were now afraid to face the one they loved and who had loved them in return. In this life, we have to do something grossly inappropriate for it to be appropriate to fear the Almighty. This is especially so, recognizing that his intent is to sever, as a father, for those who are part of his family. He does not want our relationship with him torn apart. And yet he knows that if his family are just completely incongruent with his testimony, if they have become so rebellious and so misguided that they can't be seen together, God needs to push them away and have them live apart until they die, and that will be the end of their existence. In death, reverence will change, however, to fear for many when God acts as judge and presides over a wayward soul. Everyone will eventually confront Yahweh in one of these two roles, as father or as judge. The choice, of course, is yours. Not surprisingly, Yara is one of the Torah's most intriguing terms. It can be, and usually is, rendered revere and or fear. Concepts which are actually mutually exclusive. On one side, it conveys awesome respect and adoration. On the other, it speaks of great distress, dread, and concern, even of intimidation, which results from being in an unfavorable circumstance in the presence of an imposing authority figure. Each of the 600 times Yara appears in the Torah Nabi Huamizmor, the circumstance dictates whether to render the word revere or fear. In some cases, such as this one, both connotations would be correct. Adam's reverence for Yah would have caused him to be concerned about what he had done. They were guilty, they knew it, and they were now face to face with a father that they had chosen to ignore and worse, contradict in association with Satan. They had come to value the adversary's promises over the word of God. Now, I'm convinced that the dichotomy inherent in Yare is by design, just as translators must choose whether to render it as fear or revere. We are all given that same choice. If we separate ourselves from God, then he is to be feared because he's judge and jury. And since his standard is perfection, those without a pardon will be found guilty and sentenced to death, and some even to damnation if they have led others astray. Such circumstances will be intimidating and should be dreaded. But for those who answer his invitations and who avail themselves of Yahweh's covenant, for those who are adopted into our Heavenly Father's family, there will be reverence and respect and unmitigated adoration for God's awesomeness. Now, while examining the words in there with light and dark shadings, we're better prepared to appreciate why Adam selected Chaba, because having shown a disregard for Yahweh's guidance, he had withdrawn from something he had cherished. Chaba completes the equation, revealing that Adam was hiding because he had hindered the loving relationship he had developed with Yah. A wise individual, one who understands the narratives, seldom asks a question to which they do not know the answer. But by asking a person rather than simply making a statement, they encourage those that they are addressing to think about the subject at hand and then be accountable to their response. He said, "Who approached and informed you that you were without adequate clothing, naked and exposed? Did you eat from the tree which, for the benefit of the relationship, I provided instructions for you not to be defined by eating from it?" Bereshit in the beginning, Genesis 3:11. Who wasn't addressing the serpent? He didn't convey this to them. It was Adam and Chawa who, with their newly derived knowledge of good and bad, saw themselves differently, such that what had been very good now seemed as, well, inappropriate. Being exposed and vulnerable in a loving relationship builds trust and it enriches the experience. But when trust is shattered, it has the opposite effect. So in examining these particular words, we find that Shawa is very similar to Torah in that it conveys providing instructions, offering directions, and conveying informative messages. Today, Yahweh's Torah serves as our owner's manual, one which provides guidance to help us get the most out of life. When we follow the manufacturer's directions, everything works the way it was designed. Similarly, if we are expecting something to happen along the way that goes awry, we now know that if we follow the maker's instructions, we have God's warranty to rely on. Now, the notable difference between us today and Adam on this day is that he relied on the spoken word, and we have the written Torah of God available to us. Had Adam and Chawa been similarly blessed, they would have opened the book and compared Satan's testimony to Yahweh's and recognized that the adversary was convoluting the Almighty's guidance to mislead them. And while we have this opportunity today as a result of Yahweh's collaboration with Moshe, very few people take advantage of it. And most prefer Chawa's approach, which is to augment her faith in a misappropriation of a belief, which was nothing more than an inappropriate augmentation of the instruction. That is to say, Chawa became the paradigm of religion. Now, by contrast, God is saying that if we trust him and do as he instructs, he warns that we will live in paradise with him just as we were designed. But if we don't follow his instructions, preferring to place our faith in a perversion of his guidance, well, he's warning us that there will be an undesirable consequence. The choice is ours. And now it is my choice to conclude this edition of the Yahweh blog and look forward to sharing more with you in episode 12 upcoming in our review of what occurred in the garden.